Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Chris Mitchell, I think, makes a first appearance at the Sydney Institute, but he's well known to many of you, if not all of you. I'll introduce him briefly, but first to say thanks to King & Wood Mallesons for the use of this great facility this evening. Chris began his career in late 1973 in Brisbane on the afternoon daily of the Telegraph. He worked on the Townsville Bulletin, the Sydney Daily Telegraph, the Australian Financial Review before joining the Australian in 1984. In 1992, Chris was appointed editor of the Australian. In 1995, he became editor-in-chief of Queensland Newspapers, where he edited the Courier Mail and oversaw the Sunday Mail and the company's regional dailies on the Gold Coast, in Townsville and in Cairns. He returned to Sydney as editor-in-chief of the Australian in 2002 and held that position until his retirement in December last year, and in the process, I think, became one of the most important and significant editors in recent Australian history. But Chris is here tonight on the occasion of the publication of his book, Making Headlines, which has recently come out. And so I invite Chris to talk about his book. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Jared. A bit of water, I've been on the beach in Manly. Hello, that's retirement. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming here tonight to hear me speak about my book, Making Headlines. And special thanks to my friends, Jared and Anne, for inviting me. I'll start with a little anecdote which tells me a lot about what's wrong with modern media. During my speech at the launch of Making Headlines last Friday week, I thanked the Prime Minister, Mr. Turnbull, for taking the time to read my book, for giving me feedback weeks before its release, and for agreeing to launch it. Immediately, the media warriors on the left and right swung into action. Conservatives saw mention that Turnbull had read the book before its physical publication as a sign I was doing his dirty work against former PM Tony Abbott. The lefties on Twitter and the usual news sites saw it as a sign that, yes, the former editor-in-chief of The Australian was still in the pockets of the Tories. But no single reporter asked me about the comment. If they had, I would have explained that in early August, long after the book had been through final proofing, and long after I could make any changes, I rang Mark Simpkin in the Prime Minister's office and asked if he could talk to the Prime Minister about the possibility of launching the book, just as I would have asked Mr. Abbott had he still been PM. Simpkin got back to me and asked if I had a soft copy I could email so the PM could be sure there was nothing in the book that would pose a danger should he agree to do the launch. No conspiracy, no vetting of the text, and most importantly, not a single reporter thought to ask before penning their particular brand of conspiracy. While the book has been making headlines, especially in rival left-wing media such as Fairfax, The Conversation and The Guardian, I have often felt people writing about it haven't actually read the book. Because if I had wanted to write a bitter and angry book that blew up politicians and media figures, I would most certainly have had plenty of ammunition to do so. But I wouldn't have written this book, which is neither bitter nor angry. So how to describe Making Headlines, a book my friends have allowed to be framed by my enemies? I think Carolyn Overington did it best on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. She wrote, and I quote, "It's pervy, it's amusing, above all else, it's a passionate love letter to journalism." That tweet captured exactly what I wanted it to be. And I'm really pleased to say many in the media business who have read it since have responded to me directly in similar terms. I am not by nature a bitter man, neither is the book bitter. But in my retirement, my memories of my career are my own to retell as I see fit. And for all the mushrooms in modern journalism who seem to misunderstand the nature of insider reporting, I recommend the ultimate insider's book, Michael Lewis's Liar's Poker, about his time in the financial markets. In politics and journalism, how about the memoirs of former Sunday Times editor Harold Evans, his wife, former Vanity Fair editor Tina Brown, former Sunday Times editor Andrew Neil, and former Herald Sun editor in Melbourne, Bruce Guthrie. In politics, how about the diaries of Bob Carr and Mark Latham, or the memoirs of Julia Gillard, Wayne Swan, even Tony Blair? As my friend Peter Frey said in The Australian last month, there's a long history of kiss-and-tell books in the media, many serialised by the company I used to edit papers for. Now, if someone wants to make a big deal about a funny tale of a former PM pushing his way into my house on a Sunday afternoon just before Christmas, guzzling copious red wine without bringing a drop of his own, and then blurting out a story about seconds rugby days and Joe Hockey, which then he sees as an intimate betrayal when it is retold after Hockey has left politics and the former PM has lost his job, I can only say two things in my defence. I hacked no phones. I received no money from match-fixing brothel owners. What I did try to do was summarised well by Dickie Savva. I have tried, after leaving journalism, to show readers what their political leaders are really like and how relations between government and the media really work well into the 21st century. I remind people the subjects of my hopefully entertaining tittle-tattle were not Amanda Mead or David Marr or Andrew Bolt. They were five prime ministers and Rupert Murdoch. They were the strong, not the weak. I did not kick down or kiss up. It should be clear to anyone with a modicum of historical understanding that three of the PMs I discussed wasted too much time on media spin, and two succeeded because they managed to achieve big reforms in the national interest and resisted an overly intense focus on the daily news cycle. If I had wanted to breach serious confidences, I could have written some doozies. In this phone sit the texts of all of Julia Gillard's enemies from her own cabinet about the AWU slush fund affair. I kept these texts private because they were indeed confidential sources for stories that were published, as were the many texts I received from Abbott front benches about events leading up to the failed spill motion in February 2015. But they too were confidential because they led to stories. One of the most ridiculous things about modern media conversation is the way so many in the left and the right seem to exist in a vacuum. I'm always amazed Abbott supporters now portray me as a lefty. Me, the most conservative mainstream newspaper editor the country has produced since the war, and the man who turned the Australian newspaper from a soft-left imitation of the SMH into the muscular centre-right publication that today stands astride the national scene as the only organisation capable of challenging the dominance of the ABC. This is what the book really is about, as Nicholas Rothwell pointed out at length and with great insight in the review section of the Weekend Australian last Saturday week. Sure, the book includes tittle-tattle, but none of it is really damaging, apart from my final revelations about the 2008 Bush phone call story, which I have had to wear like a hair shirt for 8 years, bound by confidential obligations to former PM Kevin Rudd. But when I question whether the business of journalism needs to adjust its methodologies to compensate for the manipulative, lying ways of the latest generation of politicians, with their hundreds of spin doctors all twisting the message, readers should rest assured, because these thoughts are coming from someone who has edited Metro newspapers at the highest level for 24 years. Why, for example, should Kevin be able to bind journalists to their confidential obligations to something such as the truth about his ambitions for the UN Secretary-General's job? Just take a drink here. Why the 18-month conspiracy between government, journalists and editors to hide the truth from voters who were told over and over in the media that Rudd was not interested, when we now know he was discussing the role with the PM and the Foreign Minister as long ago as September last year? I do not feel bad at all for revealing that he discussed the issue with me last November. The person who should feel bad about it is Rudd for deceiving the public for more than a year. But it's not just the rise of the politician who will say and do anything to get attention. Think Donald Trump. It is the rise of social media, particularly Twitter and Facebook. More Australians now get their news from Facebook than from a mainstream media outlet, including radio and television. This creates a self-reinforcing circularity of views over facts. Last week, social media was in uproar over two pieces of analysis on the ABC website by the corporation's best reporter, Chris Yuleman, who proved to my mind that wind power did create frequency harmonisation differences between the interconnector with Victoria and the South Australian grid. Twitter went into meltdown with demands. The ABC silenced Yuleman and Media Watch tick him off. There was no consideration of any facts, just a feel-good support for renewables that did not extend to trying to understand the physics of the engineering problems renewables can create. This privileging of feelings over facts is finding its way into mainstream media. If you follow news on the Fairfax websites during the day, they are often led by trivial stories about social media outrage. Similarly, the rise of 24-hour television has given credence to the during the daylight hours of the news cycle to very junior politicians who are interviewed mornings and afternoons and whose words then lead hourly bulletins and often make the Fairfax and News Corp websites. These items overwhelmingly do not make the morning newspapers because they concern the opinions of uninformed and unimportant backbenchers, whose only qualification was that they were politicians who were prepared to drive out to Sky News for the extra media profile that day. At some level, this would not matter much if we were sure the mainstream media could survive in something like the form we have known it for the past 50 years. But it may not survive. Advertising is fleeing mainstream media for Facebook and Google, which now account for 70% of new ad spending across the Western world. Classified ads, and especially recruitment in the national papers and cars and houses in the local papers, have migrated to specialist websites such as Seek.com, RealEstate.com, CarSales.com. Even traditional display advertising is leaving print, radio and television as ad agencies look to develop products that follow the eyeballs. And this is really the core of the issue for the media business case. People are spending more time on the internet than they are with mainstream media. So advertising is moving to where consumers are spending their time. In making headlines, I argue consumer revenue, old-fashioned cover prices for print and digital products, is helping to save the Australian newspaper. But to succeed in consumer revenue, you need news people will pay for. And increasingly, the News Corp tabloids are publishing nationally harmonised stories available for free on the company's freenews.com.au website. And Fairfax is breaking fewer unique stories in its core progressive AB demographic because its CEO, Greg Hywood, has been at the forefront of stripping costs, that is code for journalism in many cases, from its businesses. So back in 2010 and 2011, this seemed like a good idea at Fairfax and News. But it wasn't. In advertising terms, we used to say print dollars become digital dimes. Now those dimes have become pennies. On the Australian, my website CPMs, that's cost per thousand clicks, were $50 in 2010 and less than $10 last year and falling fast. But much digital ad inventory on the network is selling for $1 per thousand clicks. So that's 1/50th of what it was in 2010. Now, if you're in the same pond, fishing in the same pond as every other news company producing ubiquitous content, no different from the free news on 9MSN or Yahoo News, it is highly unlikely you will be able to generate enough revenue through the paywall to sustain your journalism. People will pay, but only those who need premium news and know they cannot get what they want elsewhere. So the Oz and the AFR, for now at least, are safe. But most papers are in mortal danger. I think this really matters. Even if you are a rusted-on fan of, say, Andrew Bolt's blog, that blog in itself is just a running series of commentaries on stories broken by newspapers, and mostly by The Australian. In fact, without newspapers and their websites, it is hard to imagine anything of substance at all on morning radio or morning television. In the BAF states, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth and Hobart, the main city monopoly newspaper is still likely to have as many as 150 full-time journalists. This will be a much larger complement of journalistic firepower than all the other news media, electronic included in the city concerned. This is important because the newspapers in those states drive public accountability journalism, because the state's main issues seldom attract interest from Sydney and Melbourne. Without their papers, these cities will be left to the vagaries of the balance between local and national news at the ABC, with its relentless focus on boutique issues such as same-sex marriage, animal rights, and climate change. So it seems to me that in both the national interest and in the business self-interest of the bottom lines of publishers themselves, the industry has charged off in exactly the wrong direction. It has pro-cyclically driven down its journalistic capacity by getting rid of its highest paid and often best journalists to save money as circulations and ad revenue have fallen. Therefore, they are now less able to maintain those circulations, which has then again made them less attractive to advertisers. In making headlines, I argue the real reason The Australian has lost fewer sales than any other paper and has been the most successful at building a strong paywall with 80,000 subscribers is because it has maintained its focus on breaking exclusive news important to readers and unlikely to be found elsewhere. So that's the problem for the business case for journalism. But making headlines also makes a strong case that there are other problems to do with the practice of journalism itself. Many critics have pointed to problems with polling that did not predict the Tory win in Britain last year, the UK Brexit vote, or the rise of Donald Trump. Part of the analysis of why polling has failed is the realisation by pollsters that many voters are not revealing their true intentions when polled because they believe their intentions are unfashionable. That is, they intend to vote for Brexit, but the media has told them only uneducated voters would do so. So they do it anyway, but they don't disclose their intention to the pollster. I believe a similar thing is happening in media, and it is closely related to the move of journalism, and more specifically journalism education, to the left. In making headlines, I argue at some length that advocacy groups have gained control of the agenda of journalism. This is not necessarily sinister. This is not necessarily sinister and may just reflect the declining resources of the industry. It is much easier for a well-funded NGO to get its message across today via press releases than it was a decade ago. Even an organisation as well-funded as the ABC is now easy prey for gay activist groups, animal rights groups, conservation lobbies, etc. Once a news editor, hard-bitten and sceptical, but in touch with the views of the audience, would ask, "Why is this a story?" It would need to pass his sniff test and then be followed up with balancing quotes from individuals and organisation taking the opposing view. Now listen to ABC Radio any day of the week, but particularly weekends, and you will find such press release journalism run as submitted to the news editor's email inbox. Young journalists are being given a diet of postmodernism with lashings of social activism and released into the media world without the one quality we were once schooled in during our cadetships, scepticism. Your average middle-aged news consumer might not have the same tertiary qualifications as the newly minted journalism degree holder, but they sure as hell have a good bullshit detector. They know when they are being spun a line by wide-eyed kids who have no experience of the world. This is why journalism has fallen down the ladder of trust. News consumers can tell the difference between news and advocacy, and they hate being preached at by journos just out of nappies. But guess what? News employers trying to save a buck have been doing. They have been hiring exactly these youngsters on the cheap to populate their newsrooms, left sparsely staffed by many rounds of redundancy targeting the most experienced people. This is the real problem with allowing young journalists to engage in ideological and political warfare on Twitter. Readers are meant to be able to trust the byline of the person writing a story. But if, for example, that reporter is writing about Mike Baird's greyhound racing ban and at the same time has produced hundreds of tweets in favour of animal rights campaigns, will readers trust the work of the journalist? I think not. If you think I'm kidding, check the tweets of Bernard Keane and his advocacy for animals, and then ponder whether his political commentaries on the issue are fair and balanced. He has been tweeting about greyhounds and more lately donkeys for several years, and literally hundreds of times a month. Why should we trust his analysis of Baird's ban? Well, we shouldn't, because the ban has proved unpopular in the real world. The Twitter world was not the real world. Not only does this social media activism raise issues of trust, it pollutes the judgment of the political process. Baird announced his ban on Facebook, and the government has actually been paying its media advisors for Facebook likes. $70 for each like, according to some media accounts. That is, rather than attempt to learn how the voters actually view the greyhound racing ban, it has relied on social media feedback to take the pulse of the electorate, all of which completely fails to understand that the centre of gravity of social media is a long way to the left of the wider electorate. This brings me to another point. The effect of young social media activist staffers on politics on both sides. I believe this is the nub of the failures of prime ministers since the fall of the Howard government. Once upon a time, prime ministers had their own personal rapport with the electorate. Good PMs met real voters and engaged with them. They had plans for the country and knew that getting two or three big things done each term was the best that could be achieved within the confines of the three-year election cycle. If a government explained tough decisions to the voters and sold the benefits of those decisions to the electorate, it could achieve difficult reforms. Think the seven versions of the accord with the trade union movement to restrict wages growth and improve productivity in the 1980s, or the GST or the guns buyback in the 1990s. But in today's politics, as Marshall McLuhan foresaw in the 1960s, the medium is the message. While it sounds like a television comedy, the truth is the public service has been relegated behind the interests of the political staffer, the fastest rising job category in modern government. And for today's modern staffer, a person likely to be in their late 20s or early 30s, the daily messaging, winning the nightly television news message, and now winning on social media are the preeminent tasks of government. KPIs are so short-term that the idea of a three-year plan to finesse an economic reform package is unimaginable. Excuse me, I'll take another drink. We saw this in 2010. The only thing of note Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan were prepared to take from the Henry Tax Review was the mining tax, which Swan hoped to turn into some sort of class war election strategy. While Swan was meant to be carrying out negotiations with the miners, Rudd was pursuing a national listening tour of hospitals designed to dominate the news cycle in every city from Cairns to Melbourne for a month. Meanwhile, the government was falling apart. Or think of Julia Gillard's misogyny speech. That was no more than an attempt by her imported Scottish UK Labour spin doctor, John McTurnan, to distract the Parliament from the scandal over her appointment of Peter Slipper as Speaker and to imply that pursuit of the AWU slush fund story by The Australian was an act of misogyny. And to the eternal shame of many in the media, the speech actually worked on journalists of the left. In the first year of the Abbott government, former Treasurer Joe Hockey spoke about lifters and leaners, but after his budget blew up, he went on a long, leaning family holiday in Fiji. The electorate was never prepared for such a tough budget, and the only media organisation that actually backed Hockey's measures was The Australian. How different the first Costello budget was. It set up the Howard years, and the electorate was well prepared for it. And of course, last year and early this year, we saw the Turnbull government destroy its own economic credibility with a series of public thought bubbles about increasing the GST, refusing to change the rules of taxation on superannuation and then doing exactly that, and then pushing for PAYE tax cuts. As an Australian patriot, I can only say that I hope Mr Turnbull, who in my experience did not play the media game in the way of his three predecessors, can reach back to the great reform era of the Hawke, Keating and Howard governments and put an end to the nonsense of the past 9 years. If more people read Paul Kelly than Twitter, that might be possible. but I fear modern media is losing its mission. I said at the start of this talk that making headlines had to some extent been framed by my enemies. This is a pity because many people who have read it have found the book both amusing and prescient in terms of its discussion of media. Without breaking any confidences, I'll quote some feedback by daily editors and senior industry figures. From one of the longest-serving editors in the country, quote, "I want to let you know how much I enjoyed it. Your observations on newspaper editing were spot on and a great reminder of the things that really count. I think the parts about the future of journalism and the future of our profession should be compulsory reading for all in the industry." From an ad industry icon, quote, "I read it from cover to cover in two sittings. Great stuff." From another on the innovation side of media, "Read the book, loved it. First book read back, front to back in one sitting in 40 years. From a senior News Corp editor, quote, "Love the book, Chris. Absolutely ripping read. Brave too." So I had fun writing, making headlines and reflecting on what a privilege a quarter of a century of editing newspapers really was. I thank News Corp for that privilege. Most of all, I thank my friends in journalism, which I regard as one of the most important professions of all, along with politics and the law, in any right-functioning democracy. Yet journalism still remains for me a slightly Python-esque business. The son of a widowed refugee who ditched his dentistry scholarship, I got a job where I could have lunch with billionaires, and not just named Murdoch, and prime ministers. I have had too many beers with Yitzhak Rabin and too many cups of tea with Faisal Husseini. I have been to the Hotel Europa in Belfast with Gerry Adams for dinner and had lunch with Ian Paisley the next day. On the day I was hired, I was interviewed by a legendary and laconic chief of staff who received a phone call in the middle of the interview. When it was clear it was a complaint, he opened the drawer of his desk and put the entire phone and receiver into the drawer, the caller still speaking. He closed the drawer and looked up at me without even the hint of a smile. He lit a cigarette and said he would go and talk to the editor about me and to stay right where I was. A full 40 minutes later, he came back and looked puzzled. "You still here? You'd better have a job then," he said and shook my hand. That, for me, remains journalism in a nutshell. There is an element of that slight madness throughout the industry and a flavour of it in this book. I hope you enjoy it if you try it. And I thank you all for coming tonight.
Many thanks, Chris Mitchell, for a pertinent speech. Thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this facility. And as I said before, we've got Janet Grundy's got some copies of Chris's book, Making Headlines. I gave away my book to Ross Fitzgerald for a review, and he's doing that in the Sydney Institute Review Online, which comes out tomorrow. So I've just bought my copy now. But I did read some of the extracts, and it's likely to take you through about the issue of memory. As I recall, the story with Tony Abbott at Manly is that he rocks up to your place and three bottles are consumed. I haven't asked how that was balanced out, but and then you go away and write this up. I mean, what's your recollection like after a bottle and a half of wine?
Well, this is a good one. Dick Woolcott might know it, but I think the famous Paul Kelly example was when he got the agreement between Paul Keating and Bob Hawke, which was witnessed by a couple of people, and he got it at the Tang Dynasty, and it was a five-bottle dinner. And Paul had to go to the loo regularly and write it on loo paper so that he would be able to remember it the next day. So we all have our ways.
Chris, thank you so much. And could I simply say I've had just literally got a text message from Mike Bed's social media director, who assures me that they have no external agency. Occasionally they will promote posts to a particular ethnic community, but they have never paid for a like. But I wanted to ask you, by way of a compliment, about the Indigenous profile that was really a hallmark of your years, which I think I've noticed drop off, actually, only in the last few weeks, which I think is terrifically sad. What do you think you achieved by doing that What's the future for those stories and that coverage?
Yeah, that's a big question, isn't it? I think if you go back, you know, some of the early 90s elections, the issue did play, and, you know, we saw Bob Hawke crying and promising, you know, to atone. We saw Richo doing deals to put fresh water into communities in the Northern Territory. I think the whole thing got a little bit hijacked by the Stolen Generations debate, which really was a politicised exercise about compensation and apologies for a certain class of Aboriginal people who were part Aboriginal. So that, to me, as a Queenslander and somebody who's edited papers there, a lot of Aboriginal people in the north of Australia didn't identify with that campaign. They saw it really as a campaign for metropolitan Australia. I think on the day of the bridge walk, Noel Pearson was quoted in the Cairns Post saying, explaining why he wouldn't walk across the bridge, and explaining that reconciliation didn't mean much on Cape York. I guess what I've tried to do, and partly it's, you know, in partnership with Pearson, who is a pretty close personal friend, is explain to metropolitan Australia how the regions feel. And I've tried really to think about the Australian in those terms generally. So not just in Aboriginal affairs, but right across the gamut of public policy. I've tried not to fall into the trap of being a paper for inner city Sydney and Melbourne, but to think about how things look if you're in Cairns, or how they look if you're in Darwin. I've tried to explain the southeast corner to those places, and tried to explain those places to the southeast corner. And I think that's been at the heart of the Aboriginal affairs coverage. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Yeah.
Chris, in terms of the problem with having to paywall so much against that which is free, I noticed that in Australia now you can actually link up with the Wall Street Journal, which also has a paywall. It always seemed to me like in this global-minded world, is there a chance that in the future there'll be much more of this linking up of really good political commentary newspapers behind a paywall that's global? So you get, you know, the New York Times, or you get the Washington Post.
I think there is, and I think really, if you go back to Robert Thompson's last big profit announcement, he spoke about how well those kinds of newspapers are going. So particularly the Times in London, which is doing very well on its app. The Journal now has 2 million digital subscribers, and still a very strong print circulation. So I think Rupert has always believed that you can, at that end of the market, you can sort of carve up the world into thirds, and the Australian looks after that part of the market that is the whole of Asia. Obviously, there's an intense focus, which is dying a little bit lately, but on resources. So a lot of resources copy from the Australian was run in the Times and the Wall Street Journal during the mining boom. And I think we will see over the coming years more projects between those three papers.
Lindsay.
Thank you for your talk. I wonder if you could comment on what I see as a developing phenomenon whereby political leaders, especially perhaps Labor Party prime ministers, have a particular favourite journalist, especially in the press, through whom, in a sense, they publish whatever they want to publish, so that when you read a particular journalist, you know that's coming from a particular person, and whether that's ethical, whether it's good, whether it's commonplace, what criteria do you use when you think you might be just being used as a patsy?
I mean, I do talk about that a lot in the book, actually. You know, there's a balance here. You know, every editor and every political journalist wants to get the story first, and they want the best news for their consumer. So, you know, you want to cultivate those relationships, but also be aware of the extent to which you're being used, and be cautious about it. I wrote a column about this morning in the Oz. It seems to me that, you know, editors need to be strong enough to reject stories if they think they're bullshit, you know. So, for instance, people shouldn't have run the Obama birther story for the last 5 years just because Donald Trump was prepared to say it. People should have called it out for what it was. And then, you know, Donald Trump meekly drops the whole story a couple of weeks ago. I think if you go back in time, prime ministers have always had favourite journos. You know, probably Laurie Oakes has been the best at creating those relationships. You know, recently my old paper has hired Simon Benson from the telly. Now, Simon's real strength as a reporter is his relationship with Scott Morrison. So, you know, you might argue Scott, a potential future leader of the party, a potential future prime minister, the present treasurer, it's good to have a political correspondent with a strong relationship with him. In my view, the best of the best, you know, so Kelly, Dennis Shanahan, Harcher, they generally have good relations across the board. And you should, if you're really good at what you're doing, be able to get anybody to pick up the phone to you. You know, you shouldn't actually just be dealing as a favourite. And I think, you know, I've worked closely with Paul for a quarter of a century. To my way of thinking, he is the sort of consummate political editor.
Whilst the observation that a lot of reporters seem to be more of an activist rather than reporting, but I'm just wondering from your perspective, having started in Queensland in 73 when Bjorkie Peterson had been there for 5 years, has the standard of politician risen, or have they changed, or is it the way we just perhaps perceive it through the media that we think so lowly of them?
I think they were better at negotiating directly with the voters. So, you know, we can all remember Bob Hawke walking through shopping centres, easily tapping people on the shoulder and engaging with them. It's pretty hard to see that in modern politics. Now, Joe had his own way of speaking, and many people who weren't Queenslanders couldn't actually understand what he was saying, but we all got it, you know, just like we can get Barnaby Joyce. I mean, it seems to me that that kind of rapport did help those politicians drive change. And I guess one of the things that worries me is that there's been a complete inability, I think, since John Howard lost the election in 2007, of political leaders to sell the case for reform. You know, it seems to me that one of the strong arguments the Australian has always made is that those productivity reforms that started in the 80s with the seven versions of the Accord set up modern Australia and gave us the productivity improvements throughout the 80s and 90s that, you know, mean we haven't had a recession for a quarter of a century. Now, these days you try and get a politician to talk about that, you know, like Kevin Rudd, I think, made a good speech about it in the year that he lost the leadership, but never really showed much sign of doing much about productivity. I think a lot of politicians find it easier to talk about social issues, so it's easier to talk same-sex marriage than to talk about, are we sure that we're doing enough for our children and our grandchildren to know that they will have prosperity? Now, in my view, those politicians that you cite had a, you know, very strong focus on three or four big things in each term. They didn't really want to do 100 things in each term. You know, Malcolm had his list of 90 or whatever it was, you know, sort of ludicrous. I mean, you've three or four big things, and but a relentless focus on them and relentlessly explaining to the electorate why they're important. Now, today, I think the main focus is, did we get a better run on the 6 o'clock news than our Labor opponent? Or Shorten's people will be saying, you know, we've outsmarted them on same-sex marriage. They won't even ask themselves, have they lost the debate? Because we'll have no change to the marriage laws, because without some move from Shorten, there'll be no plebiscite and no change. So it seems to me the game has got smaller and many more people play the game. So there are now 700 journalists employed in Canberra, 700, which would be more than in the national print media, much more. Now, those people's whole lives are devoted to spinning stuff like this and making it look good for the drum or, you know, some irrelevant program that no one watches.
ABC.
Question here.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks very much. First of all, just to clarify your comment about the Mr. Baird's social media likes. The comment was actually that the $80 a like was predicated upon what he pays his social media consultants.
And that it was $500,000 divided by the number of likes.
Clarify that for the gentleman in front of me who was checking that they didn't actually pay for likes. But my real question, and I liked your comment about feeling over fact, and I wondered very much, what's the internal dynamic at, for example, The Australian, when a journalist does write feelings over fact? Because it's happened to me many times where I've given the journalist the facts and they have ignored those for the feelings. And I just wondered how that's picked up internally.
You know, I think it depends on the issue. So I'm not against feelings, even you know, Kathy might say I'm not that good. Like most men, I'm not that good at feelings. But you know, I think you know, my example in the talk was Chris Yuleman. Now, you watch people debate Chris Yuleman's two pieces on the ABC website, which were brilliant. They were brilliant, as was Phil Currie's in the Film Review on Saturday. They really got to the technical nub of the issue. But many people who pulled those pieces up and complained about them have complained because they feel that Yuleman and Currie haven't come to terms with the need for renewables to save the world. Now, it's quite possible that you can support renewables and still say, you know, the system buggered up in South Australia last week and this is why. So I guess, you know, a good piece about feelings on a terrific story. When Kevin apologised to the Stolen Generation, I wrote the splash headline and it was, in 128-point caps, we are sorry. And the story was a feeling story, but it was a feeling speech that was called for. The facts of the piece were, you know, how it made the country feel. Now, I think the problem with modern debate is it's too easy for people on the left to just look at Chris Yuleman and denounce him and say, oh, you're a climate change denier. Well, no, he's not. What he's saying is the frequencies generated within the wires by wind power don't match the frequencies of the electricity that comes across from Victoria. And that's why they had to shut the system down. Now, that's a problem of physics, and no amount of good feeling will change that physics. So I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Question down there.
Hello, Chris. Anne-Marie.
Hello, Andrea. I've seen you for years.
And for the audience's benefit, I do something different now, but I started off in life as a journalist, and Chris actually hired me onto The Australian some time ago.
And you won an award for an environment story.
Yes, I did. But my question to you, Chris, is regarding the training of young journalists. I'm old enough to have been a cadet on the Melbourne Herald when the Herald Weekly Times was still independent before it was owned by Rupert Murdoch. And in those days, newsrooms were full of cigarette smoke and swearing sub-editors and chiefs of staff who yelled at you and possibly didn't even know your first name. In those days, you go on death knocks sent out at 6 o'clock in the morning to interview a grieving parent, or you'd be trying to find a politician to answer the phone at 6:30 in the morning and pleading with his wife to get him out of the shower because you needed to get a quote. These were tough times as far as training is concerned, and you possibly wouldn't get away with it these days, but it taught me how to be a reporter and it taught me how to write. I was also doing a degree at the same time, so I've got one of those as well. My question to you is that we don't train journalists in the hard way anymore, and possibly our work practices wouldn't allow that anyway. But
they do on the Oz.
What
I was still ruthless.
Yes, I know. That wouldn't surprise me. my question is what is the hope for us as readers and media consumers, for journalists of in their 20s and 30s, and for the next generation coming on?
So I'll go back in time. My first year as an editor in 1992, I agreed to do a speech for a journalism college in Western New South Wales, and they came in, they brought their whole first year in. And I put a lot of effort as a young, you know, sort of 35-year-old editor would. And at the end of my speech, the first question, which must have been a setup from the uni prof, was, how can you live with yourself working for Rupert Murdoch? And I said, look, you guys want to be journos. He employs more English language journos than anyone I know, so that'd be a good reason to be able to live with myself. You know, it seems to me that these questions about training really go down to individual editors. So Kathy's daughter, she's been on death knocks for me at The Australian. You know, I sent her off to meet the parents of all the terrorists who were cutting heads off in... Yeah, she got invited to lunch with the families. So, you know, I think it is just a question of having an editor who... And I think my successor will be just as direct as that. You know, it seems to me, if you go through the history of death knocks, and this is always a big thing in journalism school, You know, in journalism school, it's considered unethical to send kids on death knocks. But most people who've done them have made lifelong friends out of the parents of you know, lost children. You know, the relationships are not as venal as we're exploiting this person for our circulation needs. As you know, Anne-Marie, you know, you can remain in contact with somebody who has provided a story about a child dying of cancer, and you can remain in contact with this person for another 35 years and become friends with subsequent generations of kids. So most journos actually do have a heart, and they do maintain those kinds of... A friend of mine in his first year as a cadet got sent to a death knock where three brothers in northern New South Wales were killed. And he remains in contact with that family. That's 42 years ago.
Yeah.
When I first became a subscriber to The Australian, probably under your editorship, I did so because it seemed to be a real national forum and discussed issues on both sides. And when people I knew said, how can you read that? It's so biased. I said, yes, the left-wing bias is so terrible because you've got your Julia on there and you've got Kevin Rudd and you've got Sarah Hansen-Young. It's a terrible leftist rag, but I try to read it anyway. And they were saying, what's going on here? So one of the things I really enjoyed was that the op-ed page had quite a good balance of that. And often letters would be published that were in direct argument with the editorial of the day before. So I thought, in that case, it's a good newspaper. But it seems lately, unless I'm mistaken, that there's much less publishing of people's opinion on the left, and it tends to be really moving to a very solid right of center now. Is that a misapprehension on my part, or is that simply because the ABC and everybody else is so left that you need to have a balance?
Well, look, I do think the odds has been better. You know, it does get criticized for being too conservative. But I think the Oz does print a wider range of views than the Sydney Morning Herald or the Age do. I think it's very hard to get a conservative letter published in the Age that criticises the Age's position on issues. And it's very hard to see regular conservative slots in the Age or the Sydney Morning Herald. Whereas, you know, the Oz has traditionally run lots of progressive opinion. So many people would, you know, be aware, and I'm sure Jared is and Dick Walker would be, that people like Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan actually made their names writing op-eds for me in The Australian in the early 2000s. You know, so they didn't see the paper as being hostile to them. In fact, you know, particularly on welfare issues, Swanee wrote about welfare churn and welfare traps really for about 5 years from opposition on that page. So, you know, I tended to take the view that I didn't want lefties who were mad lefties. I didn't want Scott Birchall. I wanted a lefty who had a prospect of running for a party that could win an election. So, you know, at some level, there's a tradition inside media of running people for balance who are so obscure no one would take them seriously. So there's no good me running a lefty who, you know, Bill Shorten thinks is a ratbag. Similarly, you know, the ABC has its own tricks like this. So the ABC, during the first year of the Abbott government, was relentlessly promoting the interests of Clive Palmer. You know, we all saw Clive Palmer being almost loved by Tony Jones on Late Line. It was ridiculous, you know, to the point where he was actually offered his own newspaper that Clive was going to start. Now, it seems to me that's not really balanced. That's actually, you know, fostering a person on the same side of politics as the government of the day who you know will criticise the government of the day. So the ABC's other favourite in this area is John Newson. You know, Newson will constantly be wheeled out to bag first Tony Abbott and now Malcolm Turnbull. Now, I don't think that counts as balance. That's a trick. You know, what I think is balance is you give people who have something serious to say a serious run in the paper. So I hope that answers it.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much for this excellent talk. I was wondering, which is the best way for people to send messages to or send information to the journalists? I would have thought sending via text messages is quite risky.
Yeah. So you're talking about sort of encrypted Malcolm Turnbull style conversations. I'm too old to know all that.
Is it over a cup of coffee or, you know, over a particular meal or something?
Look, I think it's good to have personal relationships with journalists if you've got a particular issue that you want to discuss with them. Do you have anything in mind? Or?
I'm just wondering, you get people coming to see you about various types of information. How is the best way to communicate with the journalists other than text messages?
But what I used to do, I used to try and have a reasonably open door. So I met lots of people from different communities. I made good friendships like that. And I would, after a cup of tea, decide who I thought the best person on the paper was to foster the relationship with this particular person. So, you know, within half an hour, you have a pretty good idea, you know, what somebody wants from the paper and who, you know, is a like-minded reporter, and you put them together. That's the best way, I think. Have a cup of tea with somebody.
Finally, why did you write this, and when did you start thinking about writing? I mean, through the last 10 years of your job as editor-in-chief in the Australian, were you thinking about doing this, or did it just sort of suddenly happen? Why did you do it, and are you going to do any more?
Yeah, I've got a deal for another book, but it'll be a different kind of book and quite a lot bigger. Look, I didn't really think about it much. I had lunch with Col Allen the other day, who's the recently retired editor-in-chief of the New York Post, who used to sit next to me on the backbench of the Australian. And I said, "Why did you pull the pin, Col?" He pulled the pin about a month after me, and he said, "I couldn't stand it anymore." He said, "You know, I couldn't even face going into the office. I couldn't stand the meetings. I had too much of the job." And I suppose I got to the same point. You know, I thought, I don't really want to be there. I don't want to come in from Manly on a Monday morning and leave the beach to have another day editing a newspaper, because, as the book makes clear, this is a really, really big job. You know, it's a 16, 17 hour a day job, and with digital, you know, this job goes Saturdays and Sundays as well. So I think, you know, I decided I was going to pull a pin. It seemed to be a harder thing than people realised, so it wasn't easy to decide who should replace me. And I spoke to Louise about the possibility of writing something. I didn't actually do anything until mid-January, and I finished it on the 29th of April, so it sort of was pretty easy, really.
Well, I hope your next book with Louise Adler at Melbourne University Press is just as easy. You obviously wrote that against a tight deadline. Congratulations on the book and on the speech tonight. I mean, the book's had a big impact, and it's got a lot of gossip, but it's also got a lot of thoughtful pieces about journalism and media from someone who's excelled in that field. And congratulations on your career and on your first book. We'd love to have you back for the next one, but for now, well done. And
thank you.
Good luck.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.